Good morning. How are you guys doing? Welcome to the Planter Micro Conference on Biblical Missiology in the Local Church. My name is Jonathan. I am one of the board members for Planter, kind of the directional leader, and we're just so glad you're here. And we want to welcome you. Real quick, there are numbers on each table, 101, 201, and 301. So we've set it up so that you can process the content with people that are in a similar stage of church or church planting. So if you need to reshuffle, feel free to do that. 101 is years 0 to 2. 201 is years 2 to 5. And 301 is years 5 and forward. So we wanted to create an opportunity for you to process content with people who are at similar stages because you have different questions at different stages of church planting. So feel free to gather accordingly. Come on in and do that. We're excited to, if you don't know about Planter, I was talking to someone out there and said, how long has this been around? And I said, 6 years. And they said, oh, it's the first time I've heard about it. So we have been around about 6 years. And we exist to catalyze a Christ-centered, context-sensitive, church-planting movement that renews the city socially and spiritually. And so we are a facilitator of church planting. We're looking to resource you through micro-conferences to network and encourage you in the missional hubs. So we have three micro-conferences a year, and then we have missional hubs within the greater Austin area. And missional hubs are communities of missional leaders and church planters in a shared part of the city with a shared mission and love for Jesus in the city. So if you're interested in joining one of those, they're very informal. It's a great place to be receive peer coaching. It's a great place to receive encouragement and actually to see perhaps how missional strategies might bubble up from your relationships to bring the idea of city renewal from a 50,000-foot level down into your part of the city, in the suburbs. In this urban core, wherever it might be on the east side, that you could be with other planters and missional leaders that are facing some of the same discipleship questions, some of the same obstacles to sustainability, evangelism, that you are. And so we've seen those be very helpful for the planters that are involved. So again, there's a map online. We think that's the most important thing we do. And then this is kind of like the brain to stimulate the activity that you guys are doing on the ground as you faithfully preach the gospel and demonstrate the gospel in our city. So thank you all for being here. That's a bit about Planter. I'd just like to move on now and introduce our speaker, Dr. Michael Goheen. Mike is currently a professor of missiology, holding the Jake and Betsy Tools Chair of Missiology at Calvin Theological Seminary in Grand Rapids. He is author of Light to the Nations and As the Father Has Sent Me, I Am Sending You, Leslie Newbegin's Missionary Ecclesiology, and a few other books. We've got them out there if you want to pick one up. Mike is a very thoughtful person. He's a very warm person. It's great to meet professors who are actually practicing what they're teaching. And Mike is doing that, has been doing that for decades. So you'll find not only a warmth with his personality, but a credibility that he has in pushing missional ecclesiology and missional thinking into the everyday and into church practice. Additionally, Mike is involved as the director of theological education of a missionary training center there in Phoenix. And so he's working with pastors and church leaders and planters to help shape theological education for mission on the ground there in Phoenix. And he's also involved at the Newbegin House, if you're familiar with City Church over in San Francisco. Of course, Leslie Newbegin, great missiologist. So, but most of all, he loves Jesus, and he's real supportive of what's going on here in Austin. And so just let's give a warm round of applause for Mike when he comes up.
Thank you, Jonathan. It's really good to be here. And I really appreciate the fact that you're giving your time. It's easy for me to give my time. This is my job. But for you to show up and spend a day, or at least part of a day, thinking, listening, reflecting, shows a commitment on your part. So I want to thank you and warmly invite you, even though I'm not the host. It seems to me that we've got to learn to think out of the gospel at each point. And that means understanding the gospel, and it means learning how to organically and really think from the standpoint of the gospel. And many of you know that this is an issue that has become a burning issue today with the Gospel Coalition and debates and discussions that have come. And I'm not going to go into those. This is just a brief beginning point. But it seems to me that with all the discussions out there, the critical question is, where are you going to start your thinking about the gospel in the biblical text? Because where you start is going to impact the way you begin to unfold it. And it seems to me that although some have suggested the clearest expression we have is in 1 Corinthians 15, the best place to begin is Jesus himself in Mark 1, who is the first person on the basis of Isaiah to announce good news. The kingdom of God has come. And in that context in which he announces the good news of the kingdom, all of Israel, all Jews were looking for the coming of the kingdom. And they were literally killing each other over their differing views of the coming kingdom, but all of them were waiting for that kingdom. The Old Testament story was a story waiting for an ending. And all the different parties can be defined by the way they understood the ending of that story. And Jesus comes and he announces that in him, the ending has come. In him, the climax of the story, the kingdom of God, the new creation, resurrection, all of the ways that they understood this climactic moment, Jesus announces, it's arrived in me, the kingdom of God has come. And the kingdom is about the renewal of the entire creation. And that coming of the kingdom happens in precisely in the events of Jesus Christ. It seems to me that in post-Enlightenment Western culture, the most difficult thing the most difficult task we have theologically is really beginning to think along biblical lines that the Bible is not, first of all, theological ideas that stand above history. That's the way we've been taught in the West for so many years, especially the last 200 years. But in fact, the fullest revelation of God is in the person of Jesus Christ and in the events that he in which he accomplished the coming of the kingdom, especially his death and his resurrection. And if it is true that in Jesus the death and resurrection of Christ are the hinge of all of universal history, where the death of Christ conquers the old age and the powers of that age, and the resurrection inaugurates the kingdom of God, if that is true, and if one day that resurrection life will fill the entire earth, if that is true, then the Old Testament story has been fulfilled in those events. And now those events and what has been accomplished must be made known to the nations. And that's why in Luke 24, I've just been reflecting a lot on that as I'm preaching on that. I preached on that 2 Sundays ago, and I'm preaching on it in a chapel in a couple days. In Luke 24, we are given a hermeneutical key for reading the Bible. We're given a hermeneutical key to understand how to read that story. And Luke 24, we see that Jesus tells the story probably very like all the rest of the Jews of that time. All the Jews were telling the Old Testament story. We know how they were telling it. And Jesus tells that story, but he says he opened their minds to understand the scriptures. And then grammatically, he gives a twofold key. First of all, himself in his death and resurrection, but secondly, that this gospel must go to the ends of the earth. Go back and read that. It's both a Christological and a missiological key to read Scripture. Grammatically, it's not only Christ is the key, but what Christ has accomplished in light of the Old Testament story must go to the ends of the earth and be made known to all people. And so if that's true, if we hear the good news and have responded to that good news, to follow Jesus, then we have been brought right smack dab into the story. And we have been invited to take our role in the ongoing story, which is now to take that good news to the ends of the earth in both life, word, and deed. Put another way, if we embrace Jesus Christ, we are invited in to God's mission. And if we are to understand our mission, we must start with God's mission. Because after all, Jesus says, as the Father has sent me, I am now sending you. Now, what is God's mission? Boy, there's a lot of discussion on this. A lot of interesting discussion that seems to have forgotten that much of this was hammered out back in the 50s and so on. But I want to offer this definition. That God's mission is his long-term purpose, his long-term intention to restore the entirety of creation and to restore all of human life. God's mission is the journey that he travels in the biblical story with the purpose and the intent and the goal of restoring all of creation and restoring every part of human life back to what it was intended to be in creation. And this journey, this mission, is told in the biblical story. And it moves through three clearly distinct stages, through Israel, through Jesus, and through the church in the power of the Spirit. And so if we want to understand mission, and if we start with God's mission, then mission has to do, first of all, with an identity, not with activities. We too often define mission in terms of activities, either evangelistic activities or activities of justice or activities in the neighborhood and compassion. And all those are good and important. But mission is, first of all, an identity given to God's people because of the role that they play in the biblical story. The role that they play in participating in God's mission. Chris Wright, in his book, The Mission of God, and if you haven't read that, that would be my first recommendation, says this: fundamentally, our mission, if it's biblically informed and validated, means our committed participation as God's people at God's invitation and command, in God's own mission, within the history of God's world, for the redemption of God's creation. You'd have to read that about 6 times, I think. And you'd probably have to parse the grammar. But it's our participation in what God is doing for the renewal of the creation, the role he has given us to play in his drama. And then he defines a little bit more much later in the book when he says this: God's mission involves God's people living in God's way in the sight of the nations. We're ultimately going to conclude there in the third lecture and ask, what does that look like in 21st century North American culture? But what we see through the biblical story is that the role that they've been given to play is to live in God's way, the way God has defined life, first of all, through the Torah in the Old Testament, the law, and then through the very life of Jesus after Christ comes, to live in God's way, always aware that they are living in the sight of the nations. That's part of their theological identity. Or as Peskett and Ramachandra put it, mission is not primarily about going, nor is it primarily about doing anything. Mission is about being. It's about being a distinctive kind of people, a countercultural community amidst or among the nations. And so therefore, mission has two orientations. First of all, that we've been chosen by God to play a role, and we're defined by the role that He has given us for His glory. And furthermore, we're defined by living for the sake of the world. And what you'll see in Paul's letters is again and again that those churches are defined by their relationship to Jesus Christ and their relationship to a particular geographical area and community. Because they exist for that place and they exist for God's purposes, Christ's purposes in that place. And so as one author has put it, the church is the only community that does not exist for itself, but for the purposes of another, God and His purposes for the geographical community. So another way of putting it, I'm just coming at mission in a number of ways, God's mission. God's mission in the world then begins with God's people. The church becomes the locus or the place that God begins His redemptive work. So His mission starts with His own people, giving them a foretaste of that life that ultimately He will bring all the nations. But as they receive that salvation, as they become a locus and a place where they receive that renewal, their call is to be an instrument and a channel by their lives, by their words, by their deeds of God's redemptive work in the midst of the world. And it seems to me that very often, we'll talk about this later, our preaching, our understanding of the church basically has that one point, that we are receivers of God's salvation. The way we practice the sacraments, the way we preach, the way we do church in so many ways is about simply receiving salvation and forgetting that always in God's story, we are blessed so that we might be a blessing. I like to use the language of we are a so that people. We are, and I get that from Genesis 18:18-19, where God says, I have chosen Abraham so that he might instruct his family to live, walk in the ways of the Lord and live justly and rightly so that God might bring about what he has promised. That is to bless him and make him a blessing to the nations. We are a so that people. And if we forget that we are blessed so that we might be a blessing, we've lost understanding of our identity. Now, as I was moving through the biblical story and writing A Light to the Nations, one of the things that kept coming back to me, for example, as I studied the law in the place of that story, as I looked at the Sermon on the Mount in the place of that story, and many other times, it started to dawn on me that constantly we're being directed as God's missional people in three ways. First of all, backward to the creation. That is that God's people are called to embody God's original intention and creational design for human life. In the midst of the nations, they're to say, this is what human life was meant to be. Tom Wright emphasizes this again and again, that what the people of God are called to be is truly human. This is how human beings were intended to live in the beginning. So, for example, if they're living lives that are selfless and giving for the sake of others, that's the way human life was meant to be lived in the beginning. God's creational design for relationships. But secondly, it's forward to the consummation, forward to the coming kingdom in the future. In other words, the people of God are not simply embodying God's creational design, but His restoration of that creation, and they are a picture of what's coming at the end. They're a preview of the coming kingdom of God that will one day fill the entire earth. They picture God's creation. They picture God's coming kingdom. And that means necessarily, they face outward to the nations. Because if they are going to live in that story and embody God's design, embody that coming kingdom, they're going to live lives that come into conflict with other ways of living. And every other culture is in one way or another shaped deeply by idolatry. And I'm not going to be able to go into that. We talked a lot about what the best three talks for this would be. And one of the things I really think is important is for Americans and Canadians and Europeans especially, is understanding the idolatrous roots of our culture. We don't get that very well. We don't understand that the humanism that shapes North America and is being spread around the world in globalization is deeply rooted in idolatry. And that there is the vision of life, the way the story that shapes the United States and Canada is very different than the story of the Bible. And so there will be an encounter between the way the people of God live and and the story of their culture. So if we are to embody God's creational intentions and his coming kingdom, there will be an encounter with the idolatry of culture. And so here's a picture of how I would define what it means to be God's people, the role we're called to live in the midst of the world. So what I want to do now is, with that basic introduction, what I'm doing there is not trying to say, okay, I'm going to provide a lens, theological lens through which to read the biblical story. I'm not trying to do that first and foremost. I'm trying to be upfront about my understanding of mission so that as we begin to move through the biblical story, there won't be any misunderstanding. Normally, we start our story of mission with Genesis 12. We start with God calling Abraham and that very important text where he says, I'm going to bless you so that you'll be a blessing. And of course, that's critical. And no doubt that is maybe the seed that we need to understand mission. But if we are to place that in the context of Genesis, that is unfolding the story in terms of 10 sections, all beginning with the phrase, this is the account of, then we see 5 of those sections of Genesis 1 through 11 and the 5 sections of Genesis 12 through 50. We've got Genesis 12 right at the hinge point. And one of the greatest Old Testament scholars of our day, Von Rod, says, the way you understand the movement from Genesis 11 to 12 is going to shape the way you read the rest of the biblical story. And so what we've got in Genesis 1 through 11 is the creation of God's good world, inviting human beings to enjoy him and discovery and the building up of the creation. But we see human beings rebelling and bringing a curse and bringing evil into every part of that world and their relationship with God, with each other, and with the non-human creation. And then the question is, what story is the author telling from Genesis 3 through 11? That becomes the critical point. Because the way we understand Genesis 12 will be against that backdrop. And there's much discussion about what story. Now, here's a way to think about it. I don't know if you've thought about this in this way, but Genesis 3 through 11, depending on whether you're young earth, old earth, tells at least, it's probably at least twice the amount of time from Genesis 3 to Genesis 11, than from Genesis 12 to us today. Got that? In other words, it's a long time. It's a long, long time. Genesis 12 is in 2000 BC, today to 4000. Well, Genesis 3 through 11 seems to be at least that length of time, if not double that and more, depending on how you read that. But it's a long time squished into 8 chapters. And then the author goes and wastes a bunch of them on genealogies. I mean, what a way to tell the story. It's kind of like that, remember that movie? No, many of you probably weren't born, but that book, that movie by Mel Brooks, The History of the World, in 2 hours. He tells the history of the world in 2 hours. Well, Moses, or the author of Genesis, tells the history of thousands and thousands of years in 8 chapters. And so the question is, what is he trying to say? What's the theme of his narrative? Well, again, Von Rott, if we go back to him, he says, it's the Yahwist's great hamartiology. And if you got a theological education, you know what I've just said. If you don't, you haven't got a clue. But what he's trying to say is it's the author's great doctrine of sin, given narratively. The origin of sin, the spread of sin, the effects of sin, God's judgment on sin. God is painting a dark backdrop against which he will choose Abraham and strike a match for the first light to be the light of the world that will one day fill the earth in Christ. And I think that's helpful. But I think that also misses another dimension of Genesis 3 through 11, that is the promise God makes in Genesis 3:15 that he will crush all the evil forces that have been unleashed. And that promise is given and constantly dropped all the way through the story. And as it's dropped, it's like finally God says in Genesis 12, my people are not hanging on to this promise. I'm going to choose one person, one people. I'm going to give them that promise that has been constantly dropped through the first part of Genesis. And that seed is going to start to grow there in that greenhouse until one day the fruit can go to the ends of the earth. And so when Genesis 12 comes, when Abraham comes on the scene in Genesis 12, it's against this backdrop of the spread of sin as it's ruining the world, and the people of God being unable to hang on to that promise. And it's against the backdrop, as is going to come clear later in the book of Luke, of what the rabbis saw in the chapters 10, where there's 70 or 72 nations mentioned, and it's against the backdrop of those nations that Abraham has been chosen so that those nations will come to know the living God. Incidentally, that's why Luke has 2 chapters in a row, one where he sends out 12, and the 12 represent going out to Israel. And then he sends out 70 or 72, which represents this gospel must also go to the nations. And so it's against the backdrop of the nations falling into sin and God's people continually forgetting to hold the promise that he chooses Abraham. And as he chooses Abraham, he tells them, I'm going to bless you. Now I'm going to read Genesis 12, 2 and 3 for you. It might be very, very well known to you, and wonderful it is. If it is, he says to the Lord, says to him that I want you to go to the land. And then he says this, I will make you a great nation. Listen to the clauses. I'll make you a great nation and I will bless you. I'll make your name great and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse. Five clauses, and all of them in Hebrew are waiting for the shoe to drop. They're all looking forward to, let's just say Abraham had a good grade 8 education and he really learned his grammar well. That's where we learn our grammar in Canada. Grade 8, is that where you learn your grammar here? Let's just suppose he learned his Hebrew grammar well. He's listening and he knows these clauses are clauses that are incomplete. And it's like he's saying, I'll make you a great nation. And Abraham says, why? I'll bless you. I'll make your name great. Why? I'm going to bless you and bless those who bless you. Why? And then the definitive clause comes, and all peoples on earth will be blessed through you. That's the goal from the beginning. Israel's role and calling in the redemptive history is that to be blessed not for their own sake, and that's what they had forgotten in Jesus' time, but chosen to be blessed there so that they might be a blessing. So if you are in a Reformed community and you hear a lot about election, I hope you never hear that election is only for privilege. It's for privilege and for obligation. It's chosen to be blessed, but also so that they might be a blessing. And I'm not going to go to it, but I invite you to write it down if you want and go to it. But Genesis 18, 18 and 19 has a summary of this Genesis 12 in a powerful way. And my professor way back in 1981 said, if you want to understand the dynamic of how the covenant works in redemptive history, he said, spend a lot of time soaking in Genesis 18, 18 and 19. And I have, and I've preached on it probably more than any other text. So I would encourage you to do that. But there, blessed to be a blessing. An Old Testament scholar named Wolfe says that in Genesis 12, we have a stupendous utterance. And that stupendous utterance is because God has just made Abraham his friend. And he said, this is what I'm doing. I am going to bless you. That's the first stage of my redemptive program. And then through you, I'm going to bless all nations as you teach your family to walk in the ways of the Lord and live justly and rightly before God. And so Genesis 12 is defining this twofold way of understanding the Abrahamic covenant. Now, just so you, one way that you can realize here how biblical scholarship has not helped us is that if you read a lot of Old Testament theologies, they will define the Abrahamic covenant in terms of people, land, and blessing. That is that Abraham is going to be a people blessed, they're going to be a great people, and they're going to receive the land. But Gordon Wenham rightly says that that way of reading Genesis 12 misses the whole point. That God will bless, make him a people, give him the land, so that the nations might be blessed. And so it's better to see those lumped together as being blessed, but seeing that blessing to the nations is the goal. The story continues through Genesis with this promise at the center of the story, repeated again and again to each patriarch. Well, not again and again, but repeated to each patriarch and centering the story of Isaac and then Jacob around this promise. But then finally, 100 or so of them end up in Egypt. And then there's this 400-year lapse. And then all of a sudden, we hear at the beginning that Israel awakes to their covenant promise. The promise is given to bless them, and they wonder what's going on because they're living in slavery. Oh, incidentally, I was going to say, I've forgotten to say this. William Dumbrell, in his book, Creation and Covenant, suggests that the significance of Genesis 12 is that God has laid out his blueprint for redemptive history, and now the whole of the biblical story will unfold according to this twofold plan. But back to Exodus. Now we've got a people living under the bondage of Egypt. Now, if you want to understand this, somehow we've got to discard our Western framework that wants to say, is the Exodus a spiritual redemption or is it a political redemption, and setting those things against one another. And we've missed the whole point and the background, the religious ancient Near Eastern background. In the ancient religious Near Eastern background, what we've got is we've got Pharaoh, who is the image of God and represents the gods as the kings did at that time. And very likely, if a few scholars are right, and I think they are, you can read about this in a commentary in Deuteronomy by Peter Craigie, that Israel is bound to Pharaoh and therefore to the Egyptian gods in covenant. And it's against that that God comes and says, they belong to me. And the whole of the of redemption, as it's called in two places in those first 18 chapters of Exodus, is about liberating Israel, not politically or spiritually, if you want to use that terminology, but about liberating them from service to pagan gods. It's about turning from idols to serve the living God. That's what's going on in this redemptive moment. And that's why each one of the plagues is directed at one of the Egyptian gods. They're not arbitrary. That's why Moses says in the midst of this that God is bringing judgment on the Egyptian gods. He says, okay, you think you've got a god, Seth, who can protect your crops from the locusts? Let's see how good he is. Sends the locusts. You want to serve cows? Let me show you what I can do to those cows. You know, you have a frog god, Hecht? You like frogs? You like the frog god? Okay, have some more. You think your god is tied up in the Nile? Let me show you what happens. And what God is doing is bring one blow, and there's six words used for the plague. Two of those words are blows, punches. He's hitting each of the gods, and he's driving them and saying, I am the living God, and these are idols. And he liberates Israel from service to Pharaoh and bondage, covenant bondage to the idols. And so he forms them as a people by beginning with redemption, and then he draws them to himself in Exodus. Exodus 19 through 24. And there, I mean, try to picture Israel. This has helped me a great deal. Picture Israel, 400 years in bondage. Most of them have forgotten about the living God because of the names they had when they came out, tied to Egyptian gods. They've forgotten about God. And then God comes along and smashes the Egyptian gods, leads them out, and they're walking out saying, who is this God? Can you imagine as they walk through the Red Sea, water on either side, who's the God that can do this? What does he want with this little slave nation? And they're wondering, and finally he gets them to Sinai, and he says to Moses, go and tell Israel, this is why I did all that for them. And so Exodus 19, especially 3 through 6, becomes their vocational calling for the rest of the Old Testament. And what he says to them is, you saw what I did to Egypt. You saw how I carried you through an eagle's wings through the wilderness. Now, here's why I've done it. Here's why I've done it. It's because I'm God of all the nations, and I'm calling you in the midst of the nations to be my special treasure, to be a holy nation, and to be a priestly kingdom. And if we had time now to unfold each of those little labels given to Israel, all of them are pointing to one thing. As one author in Exodus says, they're pointing to one thing, and that is that Israel will be a showcase to the nations. In the same way a priest would stand between God and his people and bring blessing to the people, they are to be a nation, a priestly nation, that stands between God and brings blessing to the nations. And they're to do so by being a holy nation. So that becomes their covenant calling. And Dumbrell again in his book suggests the critical moment here when he says the rest of the Old Testament story is merely a commentary on how well Israel fulfills her calling. Do you get that? That's really making the significance of Exodus 19, 3 through 6. The rest of the Old Testament, he says, is merely a commentary on how well Israel fulfilled her calling to be a holy nation, a priestly kingdom, a special treasure in the midst of the nations. And so that their vocation then, from the beginning, why they've been chosen is to be an attractive, distinctive people. And immediately the Torah is given in Exodus 20 through 23 and said, live like this. This will bring you the life of God, of creation and what you're meant to be in the midst of the nations. And then God comes to dwell among them. And so one author, beautiful, a French author, has said, mission is about presence. God's presence in the midst of his people and his people's presence in the midst of the world. That's a wonderful way of thinking about it. God's presence in the midst of his people, his people's presence in the midst of the world. I'd like to continue to tell this story in great detail, but I can't. But I want to summarize really quickly what begins to happen. They are taken from Sinai in the book of Numbers to the land and Deuteronomy. There are three sermons preached to prepare them to go into the land. And especially if you want to look at, all of a sudden I've forgotten, Deuteronomy 7 or 4. I always get those two chapters mixed up. You'll see that God says as he's about to go into the land that you are to live in such a way that the nations look at you and say, wow, what kind of a God is dwelling in your midst? And what kind of law do you have that shapes your life in such beautiful ways? That's how you're to live as you go onto the land. But then as they go into the land, the story is told of Joshua, Judges, Samuel, and Kings. And then after the exile, Ezra, Nehemiah. And the story of Israel on the land is that they are on display for the nations to live out and embody good news in the midst of the nations. I think it's Chris Wright or maybe J.H. Bobbink. I forget. One of them, both of them say something like this. Think of the strength of this statement. That is that visibility before the nations is part of their theological identity. Visibility before the nations is part of their theological identity. I was talking recently to a professor of Old Testament who had not thought much about a missional reading of the Old Testament. And I was telling her that one of the things that clicked for me at the very early stages in the early 80s for me that made me think mission is way bigger than I've been thinking about it was when I was reading J.H. Bobbink's book with the awful title, The Science of Missions. And as he tells that story, there was three places where I was alerted to the fact that mission is much bigger if his story is correct. And I said that one of the things he points out is that we must understand Joshua, Judges, Samuel, and Kings as telling a story of God's people living before the nations. I said, even though sometimes that is not right in the forefront of those books. And she said, you know, it is there a lot more than you think. We've just missed it. There seems to be a lot of times where it's before the nations that God brings judgment, or it's in the eyes of the nations that God's glory is upheld, and on and on. And she mentioned a number of sections. And she realized that that was a real key to understanding, I think, the historical books of the Bible. Israel is on display, a showcase before the nations of God's work. And very centrally to the story is the fact that they are to live a distinctive way of life that is shaped by the Torah. And their lives are to be lived over against the idols of the nations. They are constantly warned of what idolatry would do to them, and not to allow their lives to be infected by that Canaanite idolatry. But in fact, what happens in Judges is the very beginning, God judges them and say, okay, if you're not going to drive out idolatrous nations, you're going to live in the midst of that idolatry. It's going to hook you, just like getting a thorn in your flesh or something in your eye. You're going to be hooked by this idolatry. But your call still is to live over against it. But then God gifts his people. We've just been through a series in the book of Samuel. And in that series of the book of Samuel, I think if we're reading it right, what God is doing is he begins at the beginning of the book of Samuel with a people that are in utter disarray at the end of the book of Judges because they're living the way they're living what's right in their own eyes. And the book of Judges says what they need, if they're to be that people in the midst of the nation, is a king. And so the story unfolds with God giving Israel a king, forming them into a kingdom, and the purpose is so that they might live as a people in the midst of the nations faithfully. And that's how we read Samuel. Not simply a king, to shape Israel, but shape them for the... It's God's gift to equip them to be the people of God in the midst of the nations. We can think of temple, we can think of prophets, we can think of a lot of other things, all given to God's people so that they can fulfill their missional calling. And then one of the things that struck me also in reading A Light to the Nations is the varying contexts in which Israel's called to live. People like Brueggemann and others have called attention to this. That is, during the time of Joshua and Judges, lengthy time, they were living as a tribal confederation. And they were a holy people in the midst of the nations, but the only thing that bound them together wasn't political. It was one story that bound them together. But then they become a priestly kingdom in the center of the nations. And it's usually, says Brueggemann and others, this understanding that dominates the Old Testament, forgetting that before this kingdom, they were a tribal confederation, and after this kingdom, they were a people scattered in the midst of the nations. Now, here's why this is so significant. When you come to the New Testament, there's about 99 or 100 images for the church in the New Testament. About two-thirds, if I remember right, are drawn from the Old Testament. And as they draw those images from the Old Testament, they come from all three time periods. And so Israel, so the people of God, are going to live in different contexts. They're going to live in contexts in which Christianity is favored, as in Christendom. Other times where it's opposed, as in communism. Other times where it's tolerated. And so the point is that the people of God are going to have to live out their calling in many different kinds of situations, sometimes in suffering, sometimes in favor, and all of them bring different dangers. But the varying context in which we find Israel, all of them are to live out their calling. And beginning in Deuteronomy and throughout the story, there are two dangers that constantly threaten the people of God. And I want to suggest to you that this calling, you're saying 5 minutes, I'm halfway through the story, that means we're going to have to forget to do something different. I've just been told 5 minutes and I'm about halfway through the story. I've been very loquacious, to put it mildly. The two dangers are not teaching the next generation and being absorbed into the idolatry of the nations. Not teaching the next generation and being absorbed into the idolatry of the nations. Israel fails. They fail in their calling. They fail in their task, their vocation. It's like one rabbinic saying says, God says, I'm going to create Adam, and if he messes up, I'm going to send Abraham to save him and to clean up his mess. That's an Abrahamic saying. A rabbinic saying. I'm going to send Abraham to clean up his mess. Well, what happens if God sends out Abraham and that nation and they become part of the mess? It's like sending out a lifeguard to save somebody, and in the midst, that lifeguard starts to drown as well. Now who's there to save them? And that's the problem we face at the end of the Old Testament. Israel is now, like the nations, drowning in their own idolatry. Instead of being a light, they've been quenched by the darkness. And so in the midst of that, it would seem like God's promises have failed. And we might write the end. The end. Didn't work. But in the midst of that, the prophets, who make up a third of our Old Testament, come in the scene. And if you want to look at one text that gathers a lot of this together nicely, look at Ezekiel 36, where the prophet says, Ezekiel says, I put you in the midst of the nations so you would honor my name before them. But instead, and he repeats this, I think, three or four times, you've profaned my name in the midst of the nations. But he says, not for your sake, Israel, but for my glory, I am going to gather you back. And I'm going to sprinkle water on you. I'm going to give you my spirit. and through you, the nations will honor my name. They are going to see you finally as a people sprinkled clean, given the Spirit. I'm going to gather you back, and if I use this language that we're familiar with, I'm going to restore you to your missional calling to be a holy people. And then the nations will know that I am God. But I'm going to have to renew you. I'm going to have to sprinkle water on you. I'm going to have to give you my Spirit. I'm going to have to give you a new heart. And when I do, you're going to be ready to fulfill your calling. And then there's going to be a pilgrimage of the nations to the center of the earth, which is Jerusalem. The nations will see, and example, Zechariah 8:23 says, the nations will take hold of the Jew and his robe and say, we've heard that God is among you. Can we go with you? And so there will be this pilgrimage of the nations. And so at the end of the Old Testament, there is this great promise that God is going to restore his people through someone, through a Messiah. And when he does, he'll restore them to their missional calling. But then the 400 years in between, I obviously can't deal with it, but the 400 years in between Malachi and Matthew, Israel's missional vision is eclipsed. It's eclipsed by an ethnocentrism that is now centered where Israel thinks that they've been chosen only for their own sake. It's eclipsed by a hatred for the nations, where they wanted to see God come and smash the nations like a jar, like a potter's jar, not believing any of them could be saved. And so this intertestamental period, Israel loses sight of their missional calling. And I would say, to understand the mission of Jesus against this backdrop, we have to understand two things. We have to understand, first of all, that he comes against the failure of Israel and they're going to be regathered. But secondly, we have to understand it in the context as Jesus saying, this is what it means to be a missional people, and you've lost sight of that. And so I'm going to unfold that in the second lecture, and I'm going to recalibrate for these, and we're going to leave it at the end of the Old Testament here at this point. So we'll move into the ministry of Jesus in the second part, and we can recalibrate.
Yeah. All right, thank you, Mike. It's amazing to see in the details of the story, even the gospel responding to idolatry in Israel's context and then sending him on a mission. Thanks for that rich lecture. Mike, we're going to go to a table discussion now, and so there'll be questions above here, and we want to just give you some time to process all this biblical theology, what is mission, and just kind of discuss that at your tables and kind of wring it out a little bit. So we'll take 10 minutes to do that, and then we'll come back together. The next lecture will be, sounds like a tweak, but pastoral ministry in a missional church, nurture, witness, and structures. So. Huh?